next storyteller this evening knew, aged 3, that she wanted to be a teacher. She has managed to teach for over 30 years. 27 years of that was here in Ashland. She still loves children, believe it or not. She loves to travel. She's traveled to over 23 different countries. She has 4 grown children, 2 or 3 grandchildren, 2 black dogs, and 3 very furry Angora bunnies. Please welcome Molly McKissick.
They're all so tall here. It's true, I've been a teacher for a long time. But last year at recess, I got hit in the head with a basketball pretty hard. Gave me a concussion and broke my neck a little bit. So I was on a sabbatical when my brother wrote to me from Bangladesh. And he asked whether I would be willing to come and to make what's called a child-friendly space for the children of the Rohingya refugees living there. I had a lot of ideas about what that might look like and how I could do that. So I jumped on a plane and I arrived in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, on the day Donald Trump was elected here. And my brother picked me up at the airport and he took me along the beach. It's the longest uninterrupted white sand beach in the world, they boast. And it's quite beautiful. Bangladesh is a Muslim country, so the women were dressed in beautiful colored cloths or black burqas, and the men with their longis. And there were rickshaws and tom-toms beeping and buzzing around everywhere. And the air smelled sort of like a combination of rice cooking and plastic burning. So there I was in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, and I got up very early in the morning for the hour and a half drive to the refugee camp. My brother picked me up with his colleagues and his driver. It's warm in Bangladesh. It's very humid, but it was a balmy 85 degrees, so I put on my jeans and my t-shirt. And when my brother saw me, he said, "We got to get you some different clothes. You cannot go around looking like that." And I had no idea why not. I was getting the idea, but he said, "You're too exposed." So we went right to the market and we went to a cloth merchant, and there was cloth piled from floor to ceiling of every print you can imagine, and the colors, just incredible. So I was in heaven. I picked 5 prints and was shuffled next few stalls down to a tailor, and his veiled lady took me behind a curtain and measured my height and my arm's length and took the cloth, and my clothes were ready that evening. My driver appeared with a stack of cloth tied with a little scrap and handed it to me. And each piece of cloth had been sort of magically transformed to a 3-piece set with a kameez and a pair of matching pants and a head cloth, a hijab to match. So I didn't think I was going to pass as Bangladeshi, but I was feeling like a princess at that point. The next day, well, that day, actually, while my clothes were being made, I had been at the camp with my brother negotiating for a space, for my child-friendly space. And, well, when you have 35,000 people that live on 83 acres, space is at a definite premium. 8 people live in about a 10-by-10-foot shed there. And I was given a 10-by-15-foot shed made of bamboo and chicken wire and concrete, basically. I hadn't really brought anything along with me but some paint pigments from my school, some red and yellow, and a bunch of white cloth. So I started to tint the walls rose-colored and yellow, and I took my watercolor and I dyed the cloth that I had brought and covered the chicken wire windows. I got some little pots and pans and set them up on a bench and hung a cloth above it like a little roof to make a kitchen inside my little school. And then I swept the trash away from the door and thought I was pretty ready to go. In town, I set about gathering the things that would be the toys for my school. So I went to the beach and I got seashells and I found some chunks of wood from construction workers. And I went back to the tailor and got scraps of cloths for dress-up clothes. And I even found some big pieces of bamboo on the beach that I thought would be perfect for making marble runs. So I dragged the bamboo up to the little bungalow where I was staying, and then I found the construction workers I had gotten the blocks from. I tried to motion to them that I wanted to cut the bamboo, and then I wanted to split it. They couldn't really understand me very well, but the language barrier and the mosquitoes, and we all worked it out. And then I had these little troughs, and I knew they would be perfect for the children to fly marbles down, but I didn't have any marbles. There were some sort of little berries, though, and so I started running those down the bamboo troughs. And the men, the Bangladeshi men, were just, they're wide-eyed. They were rolling with laughter. They thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. And so the next day when I came up to my little bungalow from the beach, I saw all those men clumped around with the marble runs, running the little berries down, just having a time playing with the toys. So meanwhile, back at the camp, I had five Rohingya women in their full black burkas who had volunteered to help me, and they would be the teachers when I left. I asked them to take down their veils so that I could see their faces and learn their names. There was a man who was sent to help me, too. His name was Eunice, and he wore this purple blazer. He looked quite a lot like Michael Jackson, actually. He was a community leader, and he ended up being my translator and my assistant, really my wingman. And he stayed with me all the time in the refugee camp. And I asked him, why was he so devoted to me? Really, his loyalty was profound. And he said, because we love your brother so much, and we don't want anything to happen to you here. And I said, why do you love my brother so much? And he said, Mr. John, as they called my brother, he's the first one who speaks to us like human beings. So there were always curious refugees gathered around my little hut there, and it was the most beautiful place in the camp, inside and out. And as a finishing touch, I had hung a swing from a little tree. It was made of a board that I found on the beach in Cox's Bazar from an old wrecked ship. And I hung it over a tree for a swing. And one day when I came early in the morning to my little school, I heard this sort of creaking sound. And I peeked through this little crack in the fence, and I saw behind, inside where my little school was, there was a woman dressed in her burqa, and she had her veil even pulled down over her face, so I couldn't see her at all. But I looked through the little crack, and she was on that swing just kicking her legs and swinging, and her veils were behind her like big crow's wings, and she was just leaning back, swinging to high heaven, and I wished so much that I could have seen her face. It was really something. And then in a few more days, the space was finally ready, and it was time for the children to come. So I waited there at the door, and I had a little basin of water and a bar of soap, and they started to come one by one, and I learned their names, and I washed their hands, and then I would shake their hands and greet them by name as they entered. Sometimes they would look away, or they would look right in my blue eyes and just stare. Sometimes they would touch my skin and then run away and come back around again later. But finally I had them all inside, and we made a circle, and we played Ring Around the Rosie, and I'm a Little Teapot, and Duck Duck Goose was a super big hit. And then I told Eunice, okay, I need you to tell the children that when I clap my hands three times, it'll be time to play. And everything in the room is for them to play with. And this was something that they had never experienced before. So I clapped my hands three times, and they all froze. And then I froze too. I didn't really know what to do. I didn't want to show them how to play, because I wanted to see what would come from them. That was my whole concept. That's how I was selling my idea to the people who needed to be sold. But there was nothing else to do. So I just got on my knees, and I sort of trundled over to the dress-up bin and started throwing things over myself, and then stirred up a big batch of seashells in a bowl. And it didn't take long before they got it. And pretty soon they just scattered. And the little girls went to play and they were dressing up and putting things in bowls, and the boys were building, and they got it with the marble runs right away. And the sound in the room really was something. It was that sound of play. So the day went really well, and the children had never seen a swing before. They had never played with blocks. They didn't really know how to take turns or how to share, but they laughed and cried and they did all the things that children everywhere do. And finally they learned. And I would count to 10. They taught me how to count to 10 in Bangla. Ek, dui, tin, char, bat, choy. They thought it was hilarious. But I would put them on the swing and then give them each 10 pushes. So they figured out, even though I was funny and sounded crazy, that by the end of it, they would each get 10 pushes, and that was worth waiting for. So they learned. And the second day went well. But on the third day, there was something different. We got to the camp, and I got out of the UN vehicle, and I could feel that something had changed. And I said to my driver, "Naeem, what's going on?" He said, "Madame, I do not know." So I went to Eunice. He met me halfway to the to my little space. And I said, "Eunice, what's going on?" Because I could feel that people were looking at the ground, and it was so quiet. It was strange for it to be that quiet, and nobody was really looking at me. And he said, "The CIC made an announcement over the loudspeaker this morning." Well, the CIC was the camp in charge, and he's a Bangladeshi government representative. He was the same smiling, round, jolly guy with whom I'd had tea on my first day and pitched my concept, and he was the one who stamped the piece of paper that gave me the go-ahead to do what I was doing. I needed permission from the Bangladeshi government. That man, that morning, had made an announcement over the loudspeaker, and he had said, "Any refugees hiding new arrivals in their sheds should turn them in at once or be arrested for not doing so," Eunice explained to me. Well, I had come to understand about the Rohingyas and that they've been fleeing Myanmar for 30 years now. They're a Muslim minority there, and the Buddhist majority has cast them out year after year. You probably remember the story about the boat people, the ones that were towed out to sea on their fishing boats to ostensibly Malaysia, but then left there to die. We've sort of forgotten about them, but turns out that I was there in a time of a new influx of refugees because it was increased violence in Myanmar and genocide. So of course, everyone was hiding new arrivals in their shed. Not so many of the children were showing up that day. And it was at that time that I realized that while I had been painting my newly whitewashed walls with rose and yellow, and while I'd been dyeing silks and gathering shells on the beach and making marble runs, those children had been running for their lives. And a lot of them saw their parents shot or burned alive. And a lot of them saw people jump ship and drown to escape machine gun fire from above. And the ones that did make it across the river border would scramble ashore, and they would go to the Bangladeshi villagers there, some sympathetic, some not, and beg for help. And some of them would make it to the UN workers, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, are there, and they're wearing their blue vests. My brother's their boss. And those refugees try to find those people, and they try to tell their stories. They try to tell the story that will give them refugee status. And they beg for refugee status. They beg for a life behind fences, and they beg to survive. So still I would wait there with my little bowl of water, with my invisible rose-colored glasses on, wishing that the world could be different. And the children would come one by one, and I would shake their hands, and I would offer them the only small thing that I had really to give, which is a glimpse, kind of a breath, a wisp of this thing that I recognized was a spirit, was the spirit of play.